Coming up on today's program, we explore changes in the telecommunications industry and how it affects our local telecom infrastructure. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, the author of a book drops by to talk about the constant change in an industry that is fast changing with telecom consolidation and a changing wireless and landline landscape. Legislative challenges and regulatory obstacles remain. We'd like to hear from you on how your wireless service provider serves you. That's all ahead on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. Kansas City, you could be listening to this broadcast in your car right now, or you could be listening to this on a mobile phone, or you could be listening on a tablet via live stream. That's the type of world we live in right now, a new world where everything is live. I'm Jabalani LaFall. It's a new world order. We welcome Susan Crawford, the author of the book, Captive Audience. The subtitle of the book is The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Susan, joining us from New York City. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jabalani. It's great to be here.
Tell us a bit about yourself, why you decided to write the book, Captive Audience.
Well, as you just said, we want to do everything live these days. And even though high-speed internet access is absolutely essential to everything we do, it's as important as electricity these days, the U.S. is swiftly becoming the Potterville of the internet. The rich are being gouged for high-speed internet access prices. We've got speeds that are far too slow compared to the rest of the developed world. And many poor people are being left out. This struck me as the most important social problem that I could write about. And I was lucky. I was in a special position to understand exactly what had happened over the last 20 years to get us to this very sad state of affairs.
Now, we should mention that you're a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a professor at the Cardoza School of Law. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what your background is, and when did you become involved and passionate about this subject of the telecom industry and monopoly power in the United States and around the world?
Well, I was very privileged to serve at the very beginning of the Obama administration. I was brought in as a special assistant to the president for science, technology, and innovation policy. And even before that, I had become fascinated by the role of telecommunications companies in internet access. I come at this from an internet point of view. I had served as a lawyer, lots of internet-related clients, and then when I became an academic, I was privileged to serve on the board, it's called ICANN, that makes domain name rules for .com, .net, .org, and all the other domains across the world. So I had been in touch with people around the world who cared a lot about the free flow of information online, and I was there at the beginning of the administration, and I watched how much power the incumbents, especially the cable companies, Time Warner and Comcast on the wired side, and on the wireless side of the marketplace, Verizon and AT&T, all of these actors have an enormous amount of power and the ability to keep the status quo in place, to be able to reap enormously high profits from internet access without making sure that every single American has it as a reasonable price. So I thought this issue was important enough to spend a few years of my life researching and writing about. And for the book, I used as a focus the Comcast-NBCU merger, which was
That's an interesting subject. Tell us about that, the Comcast and NBC merger, and what you mean by the new Gilded Age.
Well, it's a great question. We have to roll back the screen a bit to get this story. Beginning in the 60s, and 70s, the cable industry started seeking exclusive franchises from many cities across the country. They were going to use those franchises to provide basically redistributed TV service, so you'd be able to get broadcast signals even if you lived in the valley or, you know, far away from a television transmitter. So cable guys strung these wires into American cities, got exclusive rights of way and the ability to provide this material to Americans. And then it turned out that those already built networks could be repurposed to provide high-speed internet access to Americans. Meanwhile, the cable industry consolidated in a huge way. They combined systems, and then they divided up the country among themselves. So if you're in Time Warner territory, you're not in Comcast territory, and you're not in Cablevision territory. They never compete with each other.
Or in Google Fiber territory that we have here in Kansas City. But that's yet to be determined.
Well, we'll see what happens with the Google story. I'm sure we'll get to that in the next few minutes, as it's a very interesting and disruptive element of this whole narrative.
Right.
But so Comcast in the NBCU merger accomplished the following feat. It now controls extraordinarily valuable programming, as well as being the largest high-speed wired provider in the United States with these now de facto exclusive franchises in many of America's biggest cities. So in San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, your only choice for speeds above 10 megabits a second is going to be Comcast. With programming, they can make it even more difficult for someone to show up and compete with their franchise. And here's why. If you're a brand new upstart high-speed internet access fiber provider, you still need to be able to sell people television programming because everybody wants sports, basically, and live news, right?
Let me catch you, Susan, if I can. So what you're saying is the United States, where the internet was invented, and in the beginning we had some of the fastest, cheapest, and widely available speeds, we now look at a climate where the internet service in the U.S. serves proportionately fewer people at lower speeds and higher prices?
Yeah, that's what the book is about. We've got fully a third of Americans who don't subscribe to high-speed internet access. We're paying more than most other developed nations in the world for slower speeds. And that's because we've got a monopoly situation for wired access in which local cable monopolies have their systems in place, and they're not going to upgrade. They're under no particular competitive threat to build fiber, which is a much better technology for getting Americans online and could be cheap. So I was just in Seoul 2 weeks ago. There, if you move into an apartment, you've got a choice of three competitive fiber providers getting you service for $30 a month, which includes television and everything else.
You're talking about
Seoul,
Korea.
We can't even imagine that in the United States. Yeah, Seoul, South Korea.
What changes are occurring, speaking of Seoul, South Korea, in the era of high-speed internet? You mentioned you can get a hookup for $30 in Seoul, South Korea.
That's right. In fact, in many parts of the world, you can get very cheap connections. So in Paris, in Hong Kong, in Amsterdam, for about $35 a month in Hong Kong, you can get a 500 megabits symmetrical service. Can't even imagine that. In New York City, where I'm talking to you now, it costs $200 a month to get service, which is, you know, that's because we've got just one provider here in New York doing that.
And who is that provider?
The provider here in New York selling fiber is Verizon. So the only competitor to Comcast and Time Warner's DOCSIS 3.0 cable service is Verizon, but it overlaps with its fiber services only 15% of Comcast's territory and only 11% of Time Warner's. And Verizon announced 2 years ago that it wasn't going to be expanding its fiber. So only 18 million Americans will get access to this very expensive Verizon service. And unless you're in a special place like Kansas City, where a competitor has been able to enter the market by getting access in part to programming that they've had to access from very expensive programmers as well as build a system, only where that's happened are you going to have a choice of provider that isn't your local cable monopoly.
And you're speaking primarily of the Sprint-Nextel merger, the proposed merger with Japan's SoftBank. Are you speaking of that?
No, we actually haven't gotten to wireless yet. That's an entirely separate market.
Okay, let me back up.
Yeah.
Let me back up then. In the context of the $16 trillion national debt and the debates about school safety, a tepid economy, Why is this, telecommunications, the fundamental way we talk to each other, why is this such an important problem, Susan Crawford, to address?
Here's why. If we're going to be competitive as a nation, if we're going to keep up with Japan, Korea, China, which has announced its own fiber initiatives to every home that's going to be built in China, if we're going to keep up and make it possible for each one of our citizens to develop the best ideas and the best ways of making a living, we've got to be able to communicate. Communication is at the heart of all new enterprises. You can't start a new business right now without having a high-speed internet connection. You can't get access to the best education. You can't get access to the best healthcare resources. You even can't apply for a job without a wired high-speed internet access connection at this point. So it's like electricity. It's this essential commodity. We can't afford not to focus on the importance of wired internet access to America.
You're listening to Central Standard, a new world order in telecommunications on KCUR 89.3, KCUR FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host. That's spelled H-O-S-T, Jabalani LaFall. I'm your host. Our guest is Susan Crawford, author of the book Captive Audience, and our people are out there are sort of a captive audience to this discussion. The subtitle is The Telecom Industry and Monopoly in the New Gilded Age. So, Susan, what are the largest telecom companies in the world, just to get a sense of the climate we're looking at?
Well, what's interesting about telecom is that it really matters who your local provider is,
right?
Because
right.
This is a really physical thing. It involves dirt and wires. And in fact, 80% of the cost of building a fiber system is just labor, putting the stuff in the ground. So in America, the largest providers of local broadband access are the cable companies. Comcast is in the lead, Time Warner second. And then they face a little bit of competition from what is actually a better technology, fiber, and that's being provided by Verizon. Here's the tricky thing. The cable companies and Verizon, back at the end of 2011, agreed to cooperate. It's like a non-compete agreement blessed by the federal government. So they're all working together.
They are all working together. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Time Warner and Comcast are going to be reselling Verizon wireless services. Again, wireless, totally separate market, used for mobility. Not a substitute, a full substitute for a cable or a fiber connection. So we're not making this national upgrade. We're stuck with the status quo, and policy got us here.
In Kansas City, we're all working together as well on this live stream, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You got some thoughts on this telecom monopoly and this new world order, centralstandard at kcr.org. You can also email in. What does Comcast, the cable company, or Time Warner have to do with Google Fiber coming soon, Susan Crawford? This whole soup of companies in
well,
our local market.
In your local market, here's the really important thing to understand. America needs fiber connections. Americans will buy them if they're available at a reasonable price. It's in Google's interest to get the most people online as possible so that they can serve advertising. And they want to show the rest of America that you can provide cheap fiber that will actually compete extremely effectively with cable, will be a better choice. So if there's value in the proposition and Google's able to figure out a way to make money on this, they chose Kansas City after an elaborate competition as a place where it would be possible working with the city to bring fiber to its citizens. And we've all seen the excitement this has engendered, the startups showing up, you know, the energy flowing through the system. It's a special case, though. And Google, we shouldn't, as a country, be waiting for Google to reach the rest of the nation. This is a policy problem that got us to this point. It's only because Google has a particular deep pocket and as someone interested in disrupting the cable monopoly has entered Kansas City that we see the alternative.
Yes, Time Warner is the local provider currently. So how does Google's impending arrival affect that? We're going to go to callers in a minute because they want to chime in on this too.
Yeah, I bet they do. So Time Warner plays a really interesting role here. For one thing, Time Warner controls local sports there in Kansas City.
Right.
So Google had a heck of a time getting rights to that programming, which is why the Comcast-NBCU merger was so interesting to me. In its markets, Comcast can keep competition at bay by holding back on programming or by being able to pay much less for programming than any upstart that shows up. So Time Warner now is under great pressure from Google. What Time Warner can't sell to Kansas City residents is a symmetrical connection. By that, I mean you can download a lot using Time Warner, can't upload a gig using a Time Warner cable connection. The system just isn't built that way. So if you're a publisher, if you want to start a new business that involves getting a lot of stuff up from your business into the cloud, Google Fiber is a better choice.
Right. We're going to go to Russ in Kansas City, Missouri. Russ, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello there.
We got a new world order, Russ.
I've been in IT for a very long time, over 3 decades, and my take on this is that, well, it might be useful to be able to load a YouTube video quickly. I hardly consider it essential. I only have dial-up where I live, and it is sufficient for filling out job applications and that sort of thing. Yes, education, if there are children in the household. In my case, my child is at the University of Boulder and has all the Internet access she wants there. And a symmetrical connection is essential if you're going to be running a server or if you have a DVR and want to look at it remotely for security purposes or something. However, for the vast majority of purposes, and in many cases the entirety of usage in a residential situation, I wish people would stop spelling want, N-E-E-D.
Wow.
The Internet is useful, and in many respects, very useful, but I wouldn't quite equate it with keeping the lights on or keeping the fan on a heating system running when it's negative 10. I'll take my answer via the other airwaves rather than the cell phone. I'll take it via FM. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Russ. And Russ is a preferred listener on the airwaves rather than the live stream, and that's the whole point. Right? That's the whole point, Susan Crawford.
You know, it's funny. I have never met a single person who says, my internet connection is too fast. You know, there's a big difference between saying no one needs capacity, which is what Russ is saying, and the reality in America, which is that no one is willing to pay the extraordinarily high costs that it now, you know, faces Americans for getting the world basic connection. Why is it that in Hong Kong you pay $35 a month for 500 megabit symmetrical? You would get that in America if it was on offer. It just simply isn't. So Americans, you know, the Internet first generation applications all came from America. It is not clear that the second generation of applications will come from our country because we don't have the sandbox to play in. We don't have 300 million Americans who are all connected. China is heading very purposefully in that direction. They see an enormous market opportunity, and they want to create a strong middle class. This is also an element of social justice. About 43%, only 43% of people who are low income in America have a high-speed wired connection at home.
And why is that? Why is that? We're going to go to the phones in a minute, but why is that?
It's too expensive. It's too expensive. You know, that we've got this concentrated market situation, and people know that they need internet access, but when they're faced with choices between internet access and food, you know, God bless them, they're going to choose food. But if we had, just as we have reasonably cost telephone system for Americans, we make sure that everybody gets that. It's part of our social contract to ourselves to make sure that everybody flourishes and has that connection. For some reason, and it's all because of policy and because of political power, we haven't made that shift when it comes to high-speed wired internet access, and we need to as a country.
We need to as a country, indeed. Jeff in Richmond, Missouri, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jolani, and to your guest. I live in rural Missouri, about 45 miles from the near edge of Kansas City, and we have no wired choices where I live. Zero.
Yeah. Wow.
I cannot get a wired internet access at all. I live a mile from the closest Comcast cable, but they won't bring it down my road because there aren't enough houses on this gravel road. I have an AT&T fiber optic cable that runs down my property, directly across the road from my front door. I can throw rocks at it all day, but I can't get anything from AT&T. My only choice for something alleged to be broadband is a Verizon 3G wireless that costs me $60 a month for 5 gigs. This month I'm going to be over $100
Jeff,
for usage because I had to download some stuff.
Wow, Jeff, we're talking about price and reach, but how does this affect you personally?
It affects me horribly. I can't. Everything is so slow. I mean, it's faster than dial-up, but everything is so slow. You want to apply for a job, you can't apply for a job. You want to even bid on eBay. You can't even buy something off eBay from here because the guy with the high-speed access can get the last bid in, and you can't.
Wow, that's an interesting point that even I never thought of, Jeff.
It takes me 10 minutes to watch a three-minute YouTube video.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So
right.
Jeff makes an interesting point, Susan. Sorry to interrupt you. What should Jeff do if he's getting a slower download than everybody else?
Well, Jeff is in good company. There are 19 million Americans who can't at any price buy a wired internet connection where they live.
19 million. Wow.
19 million. And that's a huge number for, you know, what we thought was the leading country in the world. It is expensive to get these connections out to his house. But it's a matter, again, of social progress and equity that everybody should have this connection in order to flourish. What Jeff should do is make sure that any time a candidate is running for office in his area, that candidate answers the question, what are you going to do about high-speed internet access in my neighborhood? This stuff isn't magic. We just need low-cost, long-term financing for competitors to show up to run that last mile to his house. In many other markets in America, municipalities have banded together to make this access possible for their citizens. In places as like Vermont and rural California, there are lots of ways to do this. There are toolkits, but it requires political leadership to make sure that the incumbents don't get in the way.
Right. And how do you bring the incumbents on board?
Well, frankly, they have no particular interest in getting on board. Right now, I'm being trolled right and left by people who say, oh, you know, Crawford is just cherry-picking facts and she's making this up. They're being paid, I'm pretty confident, by the incumbents to attack me. You know, the politics of political destruction is not beyond these companies. They will not get on board unless they are told they have to. When FDR came into office in the 30s...
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Private electrical utilities controlled the distribution and transmission of electricity in America. So 90% of farmers did not have electricity in the mid-30s. And at the same time, little kids in New York City were playing with electric toys. And Roosevelt, because he had a lot of experience in the South and in rural areas, decided that this was just unthinkable. And he took on those private electrical companies. But it took his leadership taking on special interests and driving this forward as a matter of national priority to make sure that the country was in a better place. And for that reason, you can just flip on an electrical switch in your home. We used to think of electricity as a luxury. It's now a utility. It's the same thing for high-speed internet access.
And the same thing for IT information downloaded directly to a cloud stream as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. So uploads and downloads, this is all part, it should have no friction. We should not be having to think of our connection to the internet as a stumbling block for things you want to do.
All right, let's go to Kim and Lawrence. Kim and Lawrence, what do you want to do? Is the connection a stumbling block?
That was exactly my question. It sounds like these providers are acting, they have the privileges of utilities without the responsibilities and the regulation of utilities. And I had never thought about the added advantage that they have of controlling the programming. So I'd just love to hear more of your thoughts on that.
Wow. That's an interesting point from Kim Susan Crawford. Talk about that. Control of the programming. The entire stream of programming.
Right. You know, if you can make it hard on one level for people to enter market, and you can do that by just having your wires already in people's houses, so it's hard to get access to rights of way, just imagine how hard it gets for the competitor to enter the market if they can't get access to sports and news programming at a reasonable price. Right now, a smaller company coming into a place like Kansas City, Google, for example, not smaller, but in terms of its upstart nature, Google has fewer subscribers to TV programming than Comcast or Time Warner does, which means that Google or a company like it will pay 3 to 4 times what the big guys pay for access to the same programming. That means that somehow the competitor has to pass those costs for programming down onto its subscribers, and it makes the whole economic model really difficult to carry off. So we shouldn't ignore the impact of vertically integrated, you know, broadband providers on this entire story, and cable plays out that story extremely well.
Our guest is Susan Crawford, author of the book Captive Audience. We're talking to our captive audience right now. The subtitle of that book is The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the Gilded Age. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, a brick break. That's interesting. When we return, we talk about specifics and the ongoing effects of telecommunications consolidation on a global scale. It's a brave new world as Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard New World Order Edition. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're talking the revolution in telecommunications, and the revolution is indeed live. Our guest is Susan Crawford from New York. The book, Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. So, Susan, tell us what happened in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in 2011. Set the scene for us as we look at what's going on now. This is straight out of your book.
Yeah, well, it's a great story. In Philadelphia, which is Comcast's
right.
home territory, a competitor was trying to show up, RCN Cable. And it was seemed extremely difficult for RCN to actually build a system. Not only did Comcast already have what amounted to an exclusive franchise, but RCN was having a lot of trouble hiring contractors to build its system. And people were hearing from Comcast that
wow.
if they got RCN, they won't be able to get sports. And RCN discovered that, in fact, Comcast had conflicted out the contractors, saying, if you work for RCN, you'll never work for us in this town again. And that you know, they couldn't get access to the programming that they needed, or they were at risk of losing access to programming because Comcast could just tell people who might sign up that you're gonna lose access to it. Comcast could also do things like sharply lower prices in neighborhoods as soon as they heard that RCN might be trying to roll out there. So just an arsenal of attempts to keep RCN from the market. RCN finally just bowed out and left. So the case was about whether a class action could be certified on these facts to go after Comcast. And so it's a good forum for just understanding just how effective and really the brutal elegance of Comcast's efforts to keep competitors from its markets.
So Comcast was in and out in Philadelphia, and RCN ended up leaving the market because of that.
Yeah, RCN just couldn't do it. I mean, Comcast made the franchising process for RCN stretch out over a couple of, you know, year and a half. Where they're very closely tied to the Philadelphia powers in local government. And it just wasn't possible for RCN. The case is about this pretty dry question of whether people can band together and sue. But the underlying facts are really vivid and interesting.
They are really vivid and interesting. Are cable providers getting in on the action? Why are they getting in on the action, cable providers, on action that was traditionally just telecommunications?
Well, a couple great answers to that one. So right now in America, 94% of people who are getting a new wired internet access connection go to their local cable company. So the potential for market domination is so clear, and it's happening. You know, for 80%+ of Americans, if they're looking for speeds over 10 megabits per second for the future, their only choice is going to be the cable provider. On their side, these are very well-run companies, of great American companies. So the cable companies are making 95% margins on the
wow.
broadband service. It is gravy. They've made their investments. Everybody wants this. You need data in your home. And so if they've got a customer, they can just latch onto that customer and keep grinding the wheel, making in more revenue, more and more revenue. They've just started doing things like forcing you to rent your cable modem. That's just gravy.
Right.
Prices just keep going up regularly every 6 months. There's no relationship to the cost of providing services. It's just a fabulous business for them.
So, Susan Crawford, this is an interesting conundrum. Tell us how this whole scene missed antitrust consideration.
You know, it's a little unclear to me why the Department of Justice hasn't looked into the dividing of markets by Comcast and Time Warner and the power of these guys in this particular market. There's a certain amount of confusion and self-deception out there. The cable entities will argue that wireless connections are fighting, you know, are competitive with them. And so if you've got access to wireless and you've got cable, that's a choice. Any American knows that that's not really true. If you try to watch a Netflix movie using your wireless device, you'll hit your cap and run into overages in no time. You know, they're very, very low data usage caps for wireless. So even if a wireless connection could be a substitute for the very low speed cable, it's not. You use it for mobility, and you would never use it to do the kind of video action that's possible on a cable wire. So there's some confusion, I think, about just how this market works, and I'm hoping that the Department of Justice will take this up.
Let's go to Bill in Merriam, Kansas. Bill, what say
yes.
you?
The title of your show really caught me. The our choices are really limited, and I'm in an apartment building that only allows one cable company to come in. We can't use satellite, and we just don't really have competition, not just in this apartment building, but in every neighborhood you go into. It's divided up among the companies, so they don't have to...
Which cable company are you talking about, Bill? Sorry to interrupt you. Which cable company?
You want me to put the name out there?
I do. This is a live show.
It's
a live...
Time Warner.
Time Warner.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Which is, you know, it's not that they're any worse than any other cable company, but that's the only choice we have. And if you want to get a bundle, you know, I can't afford those prices. Like you were saying about electricity, it is now a necessity, and I think internet should be looked at that way also. But we need competition. We really don't have free enterprise if you want to get into politics.
Yeah. No, we don't. We definitely don't. Susan Crawford, what are some of the business models for the other countries that have faster, cheaper, and more widely available internet speeds? We know, for example, that in Africa and in Asia, the landline is incredible.
Well, not so much in Africa.
Not so much in Africa?
Yeah, landlines.
Not so much? Okay, all right.
But Asia, yes, definitely, and a lot of Northern Europe and Australia.
Australia.
So Australia,
wow.
has, as a matter of national policy, decided that 93% of Australians, they got the government elected on this basis, Jabalani. That's how the government came in, that 93% of Australians should have fiber to their homes. And they're doing this by making sure that there's a wholesale fiber ring going around the whole country, connecting every city, and then making it as a requirement that retail providers get access to that wholesale facility. These things are expensive to build. You create competition by having a basic fiber ring in place and then making sure that retail providers can ride on top of it. That's what makes it possible in Seoul, South Korea, to get three choices for fiber. The mayor of Seoul at one point decided that there should be fiber running through the subways in Seoul City.
Right,
and so
right,
that fiber
right.
ring allows for a lot of retail competition. So that's a great business model. Same thing in Stockholm, same thing in Paris. You know, that's the way it really should work for America as well.
So in other words, providing an outer ring of fiber optic cable
right.
for the community.
Right. And but then retail providers show up and connect to that. They have to be able to connect inexpensively. That's right. And China, very interesting thing. They've mandated that every new home has to have conduit built into it for fiber so that it's fiber ready. And we missed a big housing boom in the United States when we could have made sure that all the new houses built in the West had the facility to accept fiber so that homes could choose competitors. We didn't do that. Cable ran its bad old service to those homes. You know, we got DSL connections to some of them. It's just terrible. We missed a huge opportunity.
We did. We did.
So we need to contact our congressman.
Yeah, we do need to contact our congressman. But let me take the show back a little bit and go to Jay in Rosedale, Kansas. Jay, you seem to have something to say about this new world order in telecommunications and landline cable streaming live.
Well, it's like this, Javelani. I'm a IT pro.
Right.
I used to work for the local utility in Kansas City, Kansas, and they're a regulated municipal utility.
Right.
So I have seen the bad side as well as some of the good side of a regulated monopoly, which is what a lot of people are saying. Just you know, nationalize it, or you know, make everybody play by the same rules. What I think we need to do is, have fiber to everybody. Let everybody pay for the people out in the boonies. My sister out in the boonies, she's got a bare minimum DSL.
Right.
And the other thing is that. Google's coming to town. I'm in a neighborhood. They say we're 33rd, so we're supposed to get fiber to the home next summer. But the way that they first touted it when they announced it, I should have had it by now.
Right.
And the other thing is, Google's going to have some issues because there's areas that didn't get signed up, so that's not universal. And they need to get their folks up or something, because when I asked Google how I'm going to, in the fiber store, they didn't have anybody there in the fiber store that could tell me what I needed to do to be able to support both Time Warner as an ISP and Google Fiber on the same network inside my house.
Thank you very much, Jay, for your contribution to the conversation. Let's go to Brett. Jay makes a very interesting point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think this is a really interesting conversation, but I feel like there are two issues that are competing here. One is whether or not telecom is monopolized, and I think that's a valid issue, and I'm pro-competition, pro-enterprise, and I think that's great. I think the second part of this conversation, though, has been the question of whether or not high-speed internet is a right. And that's been brought up by a couple of the callers, someone who was talking about getting outbid on eBay because he couldn't get the last bid in, or downloading a complete Netflix or a YouTube video. And to me, that doesn't seem to cross the boundary to become a right. Rights seem to me to be some things that have more gravity to them than whether or not I'm getting adequate entertainment in my home. And so I think combining the two to say that there's a monopoly and therefore my rights are at risk, to me, feels like it's an over-dramatization of the issue here.
Thank you.
I'm happy to take my comments off the air.
Thank you very much, Brett. We should remind our audience, we have Susan Crawford, author of the book Captive Audience, and we're talking to our captive audience right now, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the Gilded Age. That's the name of her book. Talk about what he said. Is telecom access a right or a monopoly?
Well, I appreciate the caller's reluctance to call this a right. What do we call everybody in America has a telephone. Do we call that a right, or is just part of what it takes to flourish as a human being in America? You've got to be able to communicate.
Right.
You know, video comes in the form of movies, but also the ability to make a conference call from your home using video. You could run a better business if you could be actually present with people using very low latency connections between your business and theirs. And that requires a lot of capacity, a lot of bandwidth. You know, it doesn't feel to me like something that isn't necessary. Also, there's so much emphasis these days on getting an education, getting access to the best possible educational resources. That is made so much more accessible to all Americans, not just rich kids, if you've got a high-capacity wired connection. Telemedicine. You could be letting older people leave hospitals and be monitored at home by health professionals if you've got that kind of telepresence capability in your house, where there's a screen in that old person's living room that allows the doctor to monitor them and allows them to speak to the doctor with complete confidence.
Right.
We can't even imagine what's possible with these high-capacity connections. And just one final note, people used to think that the telephone was a completely frivolous object.
We know that now it's not.
We know it's not, you know, and we know people used to think that electricity was only good for street lamps, and we know that's not true. So we're no good at predicting how these things get used.
You're listening to Central Standard New World Order Telecommunications Edition, 89.3 FM, KCUR, streaming live all over the world on KCUR.org. I'm your host, H-O-S-T, Jabalani Lafal. Our host is Susan Crawford, author of the book Captive Audience, the Telecom Industry, and the Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Bob in Mission Hills has something to say. Bob in Mission Hills?
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call. And you've already touched on some of the things I wanted to say, but I did want to point out that I think that when the haves, it's another case of the have keeping things from the have-nots, and the Internet represents something that's so valuable in terms of getting more intelligent, getting an education to some kid who's between 5 and 15 years old. They can develop so much more if they have that available to them, and that's why I think that the Internet should be is a kind of a right, like you were talking. And I think also that some cities, even though they had the idea originally to have Internet everywhere, be wired for free or wireless for free, I think that if the only reason why that hasn't happened yet is because of the haves versus the have-nots. People who are in control want to make money out of it, and that's keeping it from people who don't have money. That's my comment.
Thank you very much, Bob. Can you stream content from a cable subscription service through, say, a mobile phone, Susan Crawford?
Well, you can do a little bit of compressed video through a mobile phone, and but you're not going to see
T-Mobile, for instance.
Any mobile device can get access through the airwaves to the Internet. It's just another way of getting that access, but it's much lower capacity, and it's going to continue to be much lower capacity than what you can get through a cable wire. And the last caller makes a really good point that these two Americas we're creating, the haves and haves not, is very tightly correlated with socioeconomic status. You know, much less likely for African Americans to have a wired Internet connection at home. You know, much less likely for less educated and poorer people. And it means that we're leaving a lot of people behind. And as a country, we're not achieving our full potential. It's a real economic policy issue.
Wireless access, as you mentioned in your book, cannot match broadband speed. So how does that figure in the equation when it comes to companies such as AT&T, T-Mobile, Comcast, Sprint, NTT Docomo, China Mobile, and all the other companies competing for bandwidth locally for global domination, including Google?
Well, at the top of the show, I was suggesting that we've allowed these companies to divide up the world into two markets. So one is wireless, and there AT&T and Verizon are really dominant. They have two-thirds of the customers, 70% of the revenue, and they're just doing extremely well, huge profit margins. They've really changed themselves from wired telephone companies into almost entirely wireless companies. That's where their revenue is coming from. And they are not competing directly with cable. In fact, as we saw from the end of the year of 2011, Verizon and the cable companies are cooperating. So that's that whole side of the market, wireless, is terrific. 83% of people who have a smartphone already have a wired connection at home.
80%.
Yeah, there's 80%. So these aren't substitutes. They're complementary with an E. You know, if you have a wired connection, it's very likely that you also have a smartphone. Unless you're really poor, in which we're allowing a lot of Americans to rely only on smartphone access, which is really a problem because you can't fill out forms, you know, all the stuff we've been talking about, very difficult to apply for a job, get an education, all the healthcare resources, if you rely on a smartphone only.
How has convergence of information literally coming at you live out of thin air, like this conversation, affecting the consolidation of this entire industry from the standpoint of what's covered in your book, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly in the New Gilded Age?
Well, It's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. You know, we used to have these separate things, TV, voice, all these different ways of getting distributed information over separate networks. Now it's basically one thing. It's the wire to your home, which we hope is a fiber to the home connection. And on the top of that wire run all of these services like voice and email, which is a substitute for mail, and TV, which is no longer coming to us over rabbit ears, but actually over a wire. So convergence means that the company that controls that wire into your home has enormous authority over what you are able to do, what you're able to watch, who you can communicate with. And yet we haven't made the policy adjustment to take account of either market power or the realities of this converged era. It's a remarkably dim picture. And a lot of this has happened just because of confusion and deception. Franklin Roosevelt said the same thing about the electricity issue. They were able to keep the issue pretty confused for Americans, so people didn't understand what was going on. My book, Captive Audience, is aimed at explaining this as clearly as I possibly can.
From Roosevelt to T-Mobile, indeed. Bob in Mission Hills, welcome to the discussion. What do you got to say? We don't have Bob in Mission Hills. We have Matthew in Westport. We're talking about the Gilded Age of Communications here live.
Yeah, I have a couple of methods for reducing your internet costs or almost getting it free. And that's one of the methods is that if you actually cancel your internet, which I've done, your internet provider in about 3 months will send you a letter telling you that they want your business back and they'll give it back to you at a reduced cost. And the longer you wait, the cheaper and cheaper you can get internet from them. So that's one of the methods I have, as well as I was doing some research on the internet and I found an antenna that boosts the Wi-Fi signal from your laptop. So, for instance, I go to a coffee shop, and I go there very frequently, and I give them a lot of my business. And so one of the things that I do is I go there and buy myself a cup of coffee and then go home and get on in my apartment, and I can then get their internet from my apartment and without having to be in the coffee shop at all.
Right, right. And so what is your point here, Matthew?
I'm just saying that if you have if you're fed up with the costs and kind of the monopoly of the internet service, that you can take the offensive and get a cheaper internet.
Okay, thank you very much. Susan, do it yourself?
Well, you know, it is just too bad that you have to be a trickster in order to get a basic utility commodity into your life. You don't have to do that for electricity. You don't have to turn off the lights for a couple of months in order to get a reasonably priced connection. And it is also unfortunate that these lead-in prices that the cable companies offer will be effective for a little while, and then they'll jack them up again because there's no oversight. There's no cop on the beat. There is no price regulation of any kind in either the wireless side of the marketplace or the wired. So why wouldn't we want the country to have a reliable connection? Just as we want clean drinking water, you'd want to have a high-speed wired connection that costs about $30-$40 a month, and that's where we should be heading.
What in your mind stands in our way to achieving cheaper, faster, and more available bandwidth speeds, Susan Crawford?
What stands in our way is political backbone. Just the, you know, the sense that this is important enough for our national leaders and our city leaders to take a stand. Your mayors there in Kansas City did this. They decided that they wanted to affect their internet access situation, and local mayors across the country are looking into it. I don't know if your readers know this, your listeners. In 19 states in America, there are barriers to cities doing this for themselves. These barriers have been erected by the incumbents lobbying the state legislatures. So you need political will to overcome those barriers, to maybe get rid of those terrible state laws. At the national level, you need to say, this is a matter of priority. We've got to make sure that our country can compete. Without that leadership, the incumbents hold sway. They just don't have anybody pushing back effectively.
So as we end, what challenges do regulators face with the deal that affects us directly here in Kansas City, a 70% bid for Sprint Nextel with a pending deal by SoftBank of Japan? What are we looking at?
Well, it's an interesting bid because, you know, you could see Sprint being a more effective competitor to Verizon and AT&T. Here's the problem. When SoftBank looks into our underlying infrastructure in the United States, I think they're going to be surprised that we've got some really old fiber in this country, even the existing fiber. needs to be upgraded in order to carry the kinds of communications that Sprint wants to have. So I hope, I wish SoftBank the best. I hope they disrupt the wireless side of this. That's not going to change the basic problem, which is that we need better wires to every home. 95% of a wireless connection is a fixed wire. And without that, we're going to be left in the dust as other countries just steam past us, as they already have.
So it's poor infrastructure, in other words. How do we get better wires?
How do we get better wires? And that's a political problem. It takes political will. It takes saying, let's get low-cost financing and infrastructure bank set up so that competitors can build these systems. Let's make sure that content is separated from the conduit so that the cable actors can't use their control over programming to keep competition out. Let's make sure that every wholesale fiber ring in America has lots of places where retail guys can connect. There are a lot of moves we have to take, and it's going to take political will and getting this on the radar screen of Americans. That's my most important message today.
Our guest is Susan Crawford, author of the book Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the Gilded Age. And this is A New World Order on Central Standard and my last broadcast here at KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Jabalani LaFall, signing off in the words of Gil Scott Heron. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution is live.